This is Anthony Lawler, Architecture and Psyche, a lecture on May 9th, 2014. This was recorded on DVD. There were quite a few images on this presentation, and those are on the in the library at the Jung Society.
Welcome. As Bunny mentioned, my name is Ann Taylor. I serve as the newsletter editor for the C.G. Jung Society of Seattle. We appreciate you coming out this evening as we begin this Mother's Day weekend. Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers in the audience. The mother archetype, though, touches us all, doesn't it? Mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, and of course, home. The archetype of home provides the container for mother and all of her associations. Anthony Lawler knows a thing or two about home and its important role. Home provides the foundation to a family's happiness. And Anthony Lawler views the home, the well-designed home, as the blueprint of one's soul. So he's not your average architect. Anthony Lawler holds a Master's of Architecture degree from University of California in Berkeley. He has published several books, including The Temple in the House, Finding the Sacred in Everyday Architecture, 24 Patterns of Wisdom, Navigating the Challenges and Awakenings of the Human Journey,
Thank you, Anne, and thank all of you for coming, and thank you for having me here. It's wonderful to be here to talk about this subject that is dear to my heart, and I think dear to most of us when we think about it for a minute. From the moment that we are born, we are in architecture. Was anyone here born in the forest? Or in a field, or on a mountaintop. And even if you had been, there'd be some designed element there, a tent, some designed object. So if we want to understand our mind and our body, architecture is a very important aspect of that because it's right there along with our mind and our body. And architecture is more than style. It's more than just function. It's more than square footage. It's more than real estate value. It has a deep resonance with the deeper parts of our being and how we function in the world. So I'm going to go through that here. And hopefully by the end of tonight, you will not see your environment in the same way. You'll have a completely new view of your environment. The first thing I want to talk about is where does architecture come from? It's always there, it's always around us, but we don't think of where did it arise from? So I want to take a step back from architecture and start with consciousness. And as all mythologies and all descriptions of the world begin, it starts with a vast ocean of undifferentiated being. And within that ocean of consciousness, we become aware of ourself. Consciousness turns back on itself and becomes aware of itself. And our individuality is born. And once we have that sense of individuality, we have this sense of being at the center of things, and we have a circle of perception. So each of you sitting in your chair is experiencing yourself as sitting at the center of a circle of your perception. And as you move through your day, drive on the freeway to work, be at work, go to a restaurant, we're always at the center of this perceptual experience. And then through that experience of perception, we experience ourselves at the center. And we experience what we perceive as the other. there's that sense of self and other. And we experience that oneness of our consciousness splitting. It's not really split, but it appears to be split into self and other. And for many of us, that opens up a kind of primal wound, where the oneness of consciousness and experience of life is experienced as this gap, this break in life. And when we experience that wound, we try to come up with some system to deal with it, to heal that wound or protect ourselves from that wound. And one of the systems we come up with is architecture. You mentioned architecture in the home. One of the functions of the home is a sense of stability, a sense of order, a sense of this is my place in the world, in a world that can seem chaotic, beyond our understanding, a mystery, something that doesn't fit, no matter how much we try to fit it into a grid of belief system or try to define it, it's always elusive. And so one of the things about home is it gives us that place where we can come and find that familiarity of stability. And one of the essential experiences of home is it's a place for our body, where consciousness and our body find this resting place. And this is where we get to the expression of mind, body, and architecture. This is a photograph of Australian Aborigines, and I love this photograph because their ritual space, their costumes, are a reflection of each other. And then this picture on the right of these New York architects, they're of a totally different tribe. But there's that same connection between who they are and the spaces that they create. And in the middle there is, I forgot his first name, Van Allen, who designed the Chrysler Building with his Chrysler Building headdress. So this is a key theme in what I'll be going over tonight, is this intimate relationship between who we are, how we perceive the world, and the environments that we inhabit. So often in classical architecture, there's a literal reflection of the human physiognomy. So this church in Florence has this face to greet you up at the top of the hill as you climb the mountain to come up to this church. And this grid of architecture is articulated in different ways for the different rooms in the house to reflect different aspects of our psyche. The experience of the bathroom is different than the experience of the bedroom, which is different than the experience of the kitchen. And each of those places, there's a certain aspect of who we are that's connected to the wholeness of who we are. And if we take the rooms of a house all together, I believe that it's a reflection of the totality of our psyche. So, what are the archetypes of architecture? Now, hundreds of times a day we have an archetypal pattern of thinking. We desire something, we search for it, and we find it. So we're hungry, we go to the refrigerator, we search for something in the refrigerator, and we find it. We're hungry for some knowledge. We search in the old days, go to a library, now we just tap our device and search for it and find it. And even our whole life journey can be this desire for something, searching for it, and finding it. So every piece of architecture reflects this archetypal pattern of experience. So whether it's a 7-Eleven or Chartres Cathedral in France, there's a gate, there's a path, and there's a place of arrival. So that gate is that reflection of desire, that path is that reflection of that search, and that place is the reflection of that sense of finding something. So this is just a house in Mill Valley, California, where there's a gate, a driveway up to it, and place of arrival. Now, the gate seems like a simple element, but it's a whole universe of experience. And whatever the gate style is, whether it's this remnant of a temple in Greece in the upper left-hand corner, this entrance to a mosque in Paris, this entrance to its contemporary house, this fantasy one in the lower left-hand corner with the two guitars on bordering the gate. The outer form can be different, but the underlying archetype, organizing thread of the archetype is the same. So what are those archetypes of the gate? The first are the twin pillars. Whenever we approach a threshold in our life, a gate, we have hope and fear. We want to see what's on the other side of that gate, but we're not sure we want to see what's on the other side of that gate. A number of years ago, I did a project where I worked with a group of inmates in a prison in Cumberland, Maryland, to design a meditation garden. And I asked them, in terms of the gateway to this garden, what do you hope for? To get out of here? What are you afraid of? Getting out of here. It was a very honest response. And the gate doesn't just embody hope and fear, but all those dualities of life, light and dark, good and evil, feminine and masculine, anything, and where our life is filled with dualities, and each of them can be a gateway. And then there's the crossbeam that unifies those elements, because they're not really opposite, they're two sides of the same coin. And then often gateways have a door panel that both hides and reveals what's beyond the gate. Many gates in the door panel have a lock, and that lock is the mystery to opening that door, and the key is the insight of wisdom or knowledge that can open that mystery. At the bottom there that just showed up on the screen is a threshold, that moment of truth when we cross the gateway. So here are twin pillars at a cave temple in India. Here are twin pillars embodying that archetypal story of Adam and Eve. This is a carving on the front of on one side of Notre Dame Cathedral. I love the image of the serpent in this particular version of the story. And this is the central portal to Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. It's called the Judgment Portal. On the left are all the saints and pious people. On the right are devils. They look like they're actually having a much better time than the saints. But and then above is a devil and an angel holding the scales of judgment. This is a modern cathedral in Oakland, California. So even though it's been stripped down to a more contemporary sensibility, this is the entrance to this major cathedral. There still are the twin pillars and the handles on the doors. the crossbeam. The crossbeam is a place where a lot of messages are left by architects and designers for those who are going to pass below those gateways. This obviously is to the Los Angeles Public Library, but it has the whole story of the printing press. You know you're not at a vineyard or a jail or a supermarket by the carving that's on the crossbeam here. I love this crossbeam. This is at Rockefeller Center in New York, right in the heart of one of the most materialistic supposed cities in the world. And what does it say? Wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times. Not money, not politics. It was wisdom and knowledge. And this was done during the Depression, when you would think they would have said money would be the stability of thy times. These are two images from cross beams over entrances in Paris. I love the one on the left, the mask being pulled back, the animal mask being pulled back to reveal the human face. The door panel. So the quality of the door panel gives you an indication of what might lie beyond it. And the door panel can be very opaque, or it can be translucent, or very open. So that hide and reveal can be treated in different ways depending on what's being put forth. The lock, the mystery to be solved, to open the doorway into the building on the other side. These aren't locks, but there were two door handles. This was in Athens, Greece, just below the Parthenon. I think this was the entry to a hotel, but they had these labyrinth doorknobs. And then the hinge that allows the door to open and close. The threshold. This is in Istanbul. I love the history of that threshold is shown there, and all the people that have crossed that threshold and the residue. So this is one of the things also about architecture is it's a gift from all those who went before us. When we walk around a city and we see these gateways, we see the twin pillars, we see the cross beams, we see that others have experienced life, the mystery of life, and we know that we're not alone. And when crossing this threshold, if we're open to it, we can remember that we're not the only one that keeps crossing thresholds in life. This is a threshold of a church just after a wedding took place there. Big threshold moment for them. Then there's the path. And how we approach, well, there's the approach to the threshold and the gate. There's the direct approach, the oblique approach, and the circuitous approach. Now, we've all taken these approaches in our life. Sometimes we are direct and go right to that threshold crossing and move across it. Other times we go up sideways, we kind of aren't too sure, but we're trying to put it off a little bit, check out the scene ahead of us, and then other times we just procrastinate forever until we're kind of drawn across the threshold. Once we're on the other side of the gateway, there's the path. And the path can take a linear form, a radial form, or that spiral form. the path can leave the horizontal plane of existence and take us deeper into the underground, or it can rise and take us up to the expanse of the sky. There's the bridge, that aspect of crossing a gap in understanding. And we all come to gaps in our life where we really can't see to the other side, and we need some bridge of experience, understanding, friendship to help us across. And architecture embodies that in the bridge. So here's an example of a direct approach. This is in a church in Rome. There's no doubt about where you're supposed to go. It's very clear. The oblique approach is often seen in Japanese gardens, where you just can take your time and take a sideways approach. And that circuitous approach, this is Borobudur in Indonesia. And you get to the top of this three-dimensional mandala by going around on the terraces. And the carvings on the side of this terraces tell the whole experience of the life of Buddha. And the idea is that as you travel around, you're seeing images that awaken these different aspects within your own consciousness and awareness. So that by the time you reach the top, hopefully you've experienced some of that Buddha nature that you are. So the linear path we experience again and again throughout our life. The path through the woods, the path through the day. Sometimes the paths are spaghetti-like. This is what they now call it the labyrinth in Los Angeles. And that's a reflection of the consciousness of the people who, I mean, this didn't come out of nowhere. This came out of some human mind. A different type of intersection at the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. All roads lead to the center. And the labyrinthian path is embodied in the labyrinth at Chartres Cathedral. Stairs are a great archetype. There's a lot of mystery in stairs. You don't even have to go down those stairs and to get an experience that there's some aspect to the underworld, some aspect to the depths of the psyche that can't be seen, but there's a pathway down to it. The path of ascent has been envisioned, this is from William Blake, Jacob's Ladder, that desire to get beyond the bounds of earth and experience the expanse of the sky is another human desire that's embodied in architecture. And the bridge, crossing little gaps in the experience of life, or big expanses. And again, it doesn't matter what the outer form is, the outer style by the culture, the underlying archetypal human experience is the same that's shaping that creation of that bridge. And then we get to the archetype of place, that sense of arrival, that spot at the center of our existence. And usually we mark our territory in some way. This is the lot lines of our lot. These are the boundaries of our neighborhood. These are the boundaries of our city or our country. We mark out on the territory of life our place in the world. And the first archetype there is the floor, the basis. Then there are the directions in relationship to the sun. Wherever we stand, that sense of place is reinforced by the direction of the rising and setting sun. And that implies the direction of north and south. If we're standing on the landscape and we to one side, we know the sun, in this case, rises here, I think, and sets over there. North and south are implied, also the vertical dimensions of above and below. And then once we find a place, we start to articulate it to suit the needs of a particular time. So before you all came here tonight, this room was empty of chairs. So then chairs were put out. All this audiovisual was set up, was put up. The room was articulated to serve the purposes. So in every room you go into is like that. Empty spaces shaped in some way as a gesture to support the activities that take place there. And then there's that sense of connection of this particular place to the places around it, to the world around it. So that center of the world sense was shown in this medieval woodblock print that showed a sense of place in the midst of the labyrinth of the world. We find that sense of place either through technical means, the surveying spot, or on this bench that this person is sitting at the top right in Paris, or at the center of this labyrinth where this person is sitting. We, over and over again throughout our day, we establish our sense of place at the center of things. We define the boundaries around us. So whether someone lays out a ring of stones to define the boundaries of this place, sets up a trellis, or this park in Paris where the benches or the trees around it define the sense of place for this park, for that bench. The articulation of the floor establishes that ground upon which we encounter enact our activities. The sense of direction. This is kind of the archetypal Renaissance house designed by Andrea Palladio, where the house, in a sense, is a compass, where the center of the world is established in that center rotunda, and the four porticos and staircases outline a sense of center in the world. The sense of place is articulated. So a floor plan of anything, whether it's an apartment such as this, is an articulation of space to serve the needs of how we live. That sense of connection. This glass house by Philip Johnson in New Canaan, Connecticut, because of its openness, has that sense of connection to the surroundings. And now we go to a different set of archetypes, the steeple and the sanctuary. But before I do that, are there any questions about what we've been talking about? Or any thoughts? Yes?
My brother's an engineer, and I was just thinking, so much seems to be designed around efficiency, you're saying.
Right, and we have a society in where people are alienated, isolated, feel fragmented, alone, and we lose that sense of continuity. And so there's that famous phrase, form follows function. And when efficiency only takes into account the gestures of the body and not the gestures of the soul, then it's a limited kind of efficiency. So the problem with that is the definition of efficiency and what it's including. Now, that's an interesting thing, because you look at the design of banks over history. I mean, especially before this period, but there's a lot of that's lavished on banks that's purely symbolic. It has nothing to do with efficiency.
Hmm. Yeah, I remember they said they used to build them like fortresses just to let people know that their money was safe.
Well, exactly. So that's a function of the psyche more than it's a function of safeguarding the bank. I mean, to safeguard the bank, all you need is a tomb underground. But because people interact there, they want to be reassured that their money's safe. So that's a function of the psyche.
I see. So it has nothing to do with efficiency at all.
No. Right, the definition of efficiency is completely arbitrary. You can expand the definition of efficiency to include the totality of who we are. And then something as frivolous as the Seattle Space Needle can come into being. I mean, it has a function in terms of image. You know, all over the world, people associate Seattle with that image. So it's a good branding function. But it has no function. Yes. Yes. Just as people love the Eiffel Tower. You know, what's the function of the Eiffel Tower? And so if we look at all the supposed functional buildings, even the most strictly functional, we'll see this layer of imagination.
The function serves the soul.
Yes, and that's the point, is to expand the definition of the function. And if it's not serving the soul, it's not very functional. And so we've clipped ourselves off from that aspect of who we are, and we're paying the price. So you had a point.
Well, I was going to say, but I think nowadays there still is a drive to be connected. Think of how the open concept floor plan in a house now is just so popular, so people can be in the kitchen and still interact with their company. And
I know, that's a very interesting thing now. This morning, we flew up from San Francisco, and we went to this new section of the United Terminal, which has just been designed. And it's completely different than the usual terminal, where there's the aisle with the gates on either side, and, you know, you're just there to get to the seat. In the center, they had an open area with the countertops, with outlets where people could plug in their laptops and things like that. It was more like a living room. Now, that was the architecture of it. The reality of it was everybody was on their screen. So it didn't matter whether they were in that space, on the BART train getting to the airport or at home before they... That's a whole other talk in terms of the architecture of the digital age, but we won't go off into that. Yes?
I was going to ask, while you were going through these architectural elements, particularly when you showed some door locks, gosh, I've never even seen such ornate door locks, but yet I've seen thousands of, you know, ordinary locks. And so I wondered if your talk would be the same, really, if you just use ordinary houses and doors. And then during this Q&A, I started to think, uh-oh, are we actually, missing some access to our archetype or our awareness? By the fact that we live in such plain architecture, do we need to have better architecture so that we can be better for our souls?
More symbolic, no?
That's kind of what you said when you go on.
Yeah, well, it's both. Because even in the simplest act of putting the key into the lock, whether it's ornate or not, there's that gesture. And how we experience that gesture and the richness of imagination with which we engage it really creates the depth of it. It's not, you know, to wait around, you know, for the locksmith to come by and install this elaborate lock, we don't have to wait for that. We can still, when we enter a new experience, we can be curious about it or shut down from it. We can open to the soulful experience of it or just say, okay, here's my house, put the groceries down, flip on the television, you know, do the functions that we usually do. So, but I would, as an architect, it's much more interesting to work with clients who want to explore their imagination. Yes.
Some of the questions that tended towards something that I've been interested in your talk so far as well, which is that most of the images you've shown have been one-of-a-kind type images, and yet most of the spaces we live in are comprised of elements that are mass-produced, thousands and thousands and thousands of copies for commercial sale, the locks, the doors, the beams, the bricks, everything. So it's almost as though there's two kinds of symbolic pieces, the ones that everybody in this room probably lives in and the ones that you're showing.
Yes, and I'm showing these to kind of wake up the imagination. So hopefully that when you go back to your threshold, you're not seeing it as a reflection, but maybe as a cousin, and experience your threshold with more imagination. If you ever go to create a threshold, you can take that opportunity to say, okay, let's not just pull one off the shelf, but let's rethink this. You know, I was thinking about it the other day. People have eaten breakfast for tens of thousands of years. But when you go to design a breakfast nook, you can ask that question, how do I really want to eat breakfast? And so much of the time now, people just take things off the shelf. But there's that opportunity of soulful engagement. And it doesn't have to be, you know, you don't have to spend $100,000 on a remodeling to remodel. You know, it's just where you sit, how you approach it, the plate you put down there can all be engaged. And that's the opportunity for architecture as a tool for soulful experience. You can use the physical environment as a vehicle for soulful engagement. And so one of the things to contemplate might be, and be curious about, is, okay, we're interacting with these, in quotes, mundane objects, to drop that idea that they're mundane and really look at them. Really experience the steering wheel of your car. It's a pretty miraculous thing. You know, and if you want to get into the whole symbolic, the symbol of the soul is the circle, and it's a catalyst for imagination. So there's a lot of richness there in the so-called mundane things. Yes. Yeah.
It sounds, what you're describing sounds to me like bringing ritual into the experience. Like when you talk about escaping from the mundane when you're eating breakfast, it sounds like that is almost creating a ritual experience instead of just sort of mindlessly going through those steps, right?
Well, it's becoming conscious of the ritual that we're already doing. Because we go through our day, it's a whole ritual. Mostly when we wake up in the morning and stumble into the bathroom, to the altar of the sink, and the mirror, we do it in pretty much the same way. It's like a ritual. But we're not conscious of it. As a pattern of behavior that we engage in. Well, okay, your routine can become a ritual. That's how it becomes a ritual, because it becomes more soulful by becoming aware and conscious of what's going on. So, yes, that's a good point. So architecture is the place that supports our routines and the opportunity to turn life into a soulful ritual just by becoming conscious of it. And that's what these patterns are that I'm talking about. And they're not patterns that you have to think about including. They're not something off the shelf. It's not such a just an philosophical concept. To have a building, you have to have a doorway. To have a building, you have to have a passageway through it. To have a building, you have to have a place of arrival. And so those forms are the stage set for the ritual. So the ritual becomes obvious in a cathedral because everything about it is saying, come on down for the ritual here. But it's not so obvious when you go into Whole Foods. But the same opportunity is there to go through the abundance and of in the aisles there. Yeah. Yes, it's a seduction, and maybe our job is to engage that in a way where we remember that we are there being seduced and engage it with consciousness so that we buy what we actually want and not what we think we need, what they're telling us
we need.
Yes?
I'd be really curious to hear your thoughts about the connection with our sense of time. Because it strikes me, you know, as you were talking about this, one of the things I kept thinking is that, yeah, but, you know, the reason I drop out of that ability to see these things is because sometimes I feel like I'm in a hurry. And it just, it feels like a lot of this kind of comes down to that. But I'm curious about your thoughts.
Well, there's this idea that to be soulful and have soulful experience or ritual, that it has to be quiet, it has to be slow, we need time to do it. Now, if you go to some of the most sacred places on earth, such as Benares in India, it's chaos there. You know, there's burning, there's funeral pyres going on. Just down the way, a couple hundred feet, there are wedding parties being taken out onto the river. There's chanting going on. There's people bathing in the Ganges. It's chaos. What I think we miss is that stillness is always there in the background. So just like in this room, there's space. We wouldn't have this room. There's all the objects within the room, but there's a space within the room. And there's a great phrase from the Tao Te Ching that says, we hammer wood for a house, but it's the space inside that makes it livable. And that's space is always there within every environment that we're inhabiting, but it's also there in our awareness. Because right now, as you're having a thought or perceiving what's there, there's an aspect of you that's perceiving that thought. And my experience is that's silent. It's always been there. It's always, you know, the same silence has been in the background looking out through these eyes as when I was 5 years old, as when I was 20 years old, and now. And so that's spaciousness, that silence is always there whether things are in a hurry or whether we're sitting on the meditation cushion. And that's, again, where architecture can help us, to remind us that spaciousness is there. So even, you know, today as tourists, we went down to Pike Place Market, you know, and it was swamped in there. But there was the space of the place, too, that was in the background. And to just, in the midst of all that, to just be curious and to notice that this is all happening within that space. So it's easier when we're sitting in a quiet place on a meditation cushion. But it can be more fun to be in, you know, New York or Benares or Seattle and have that enlivenment of the senses along with that silence.
Yes.
I just want to say, I do what I think you spoke of, but I see architecture as an outpicture of my mind. Mm-hmm. As in, this building here is wonderful. There's
yes.
Media. I mean, it's got all these surprising rooms and, you know, the library that you wouldn't know. There's a chapel up there, way up about the third floor. It's bigger than this room. There's got these pink, stained glass windows. That's like the mind to me, you know. It has these surprising sacred spaces, and I'm so glad we're going to move at one time. Maybe there's gardens outside. We're going to move somewhere else. And I just thought, oh, we can't give up the Jungian Society meeting here because this is a soul.
And it's a place of imagination where those things we were talking about, those qualities of the soul, were seen as part of the function in the design.
And you showed Paris a lot.
Mm-hmm.
If I get to Paris, tears just come down my eyes because it's so much about what individuality. I mean, every corner. The streets that you walk on, your sunbursts, and the sidewalks are really amazing. They're not just straight. You run out of sidewalk all the time, then it opens up again. It's just kind of wavering. And you're in the street and out of the street, and it's just a fun place.
There's imagination and specificity with a particular place. So that's the opposite of the off-the-shelf city. You know, the curb of the sidewalk is not designed according to some government specification. It says to you, we were individuals here. Come on, bring out your individuality. And I think that's one of the things people love about Paris, is it invites that, you know, we call it romance, but it's really just being the imaginative beings that we are.
Yes.
I was going to say, Benares is my favorite place on Earth, but part of it is just the sheer antiquity of the place.
Yes.
Like the ancestors are in the soil, some people would say the ancestors are in the soil, and it connects you with the collective unconscious in a really incredible kind of...
Yes, that's something we don't have so much here because we haven't inhabited this place for so long. So one of the places I showed, Chartres Cathedral, and the floor is limestone, and it's polished, but it's not polished. It wasn't polished originally, or maybe it was, but it's been polished by almost 1,000 years of pilgrims' feet walking across that floor. And so we sense that, the depth of that. And that's the other thing about architecture. About 10 years ago, when I took that photo, I took a year and a half off and I traveled around to sacred places in all parts of the world. And I started to call them storehouses of human experience, storehouses of human wisdom. And it seemed that every culture created places that said, this was our experience. This, we don't know exactly what the hell is going on here in this world. And maybe you don't either, but this is what we learned. And this is what we wanted to leave for you. And so that sense of connectedness, that's the thing we can see in architecture, even if it's recent architecture. The chair you're sitting on, someone someplace sat there and designed the detail of that. Their imagination took those materials and shaped them into that chair. And so you're connecting to that person in some way just by sitting on that chair. And so everywhere we go, every plant we see, every sign on the street, every piece of clothing someone's wearing is all created by human endeavor, human imagination. And it's an opportunity and it can be a reminder to connect and become aware of that human imagination being infused throughout the environment. You know, we literally are living within human imagination. It's not some mystical, abstract thing. Every detail of this room was imagined by someone. and took the raw materials of nature and shaped them into the specific forms that we see. And we're living within that imagination right now. We do that throughout our day. Yes?
Well, I guess most houses don't have any place of worship. So we have our stomach, which is the kitchen and so on. But when we have a library for the mind, but we don't have a chapel. But then we have a church every few blocks all around North Seattle here.
Mm-hmm.
So does that mean that the Western concept of God is something that's outside of ourselves?
Well, that's up to individual interpretation. And we do have a place of worship. Well, most people do. It's their television set. And, yeah, I mean, our culture, a lot is based on duality and separation. Our primary cultural myth of Adam and Eve is eating the apple with the knowledge of good and evil, that somehow not the world is divided into parts rather than as some integrated whole that has different fluctuations of experience within it. And so that's a big part of Western culture, is separating the sacred from the profane, from daily life, from the soul. And it seems that we've experienced the consequences of that, and it seems that one thing we can do is strive to reintegrate that and find soulfulness where there doesn't seem to be any. And one way, and this is what I'm presenting here, is the things around us. They're not separate from who we are. They're an integral part of who we are, and we can use them as vehicles to weave our world back together. So, let's go on to some more archetypes. So another archetype is the one of the steeple and the sanctuary. There's that aspect within us to have aspiration, to aspire, to strive for something bigger, grander, higher. And then there's also that aspect within us to turn within, to go into the sanctuary. And the steeple is that energy of rising, verticality. The sanctuary is that idea of turning inward, of centeredness, of gathering. This is a diagram of a Buddhist diagram of a stupa related to the five elements. The bottom is the square relates to earth, the circle relates to water, the triangle relates to fire, and the little crescent up there relates to air, and I guess the diamond relates to space. So that the steeple has this embodiment of this grounded at the base and more ethereal and ephemeral as it gets up toward the top. Within the steeple is the sanctuary, the belly of the whale experience. And then there's the sanctuary, that gathering place. So usually often in buildings, we see this combination of steeple and sanctuary. So on the left is a church in Italy, and on the right is Union Station in Los Angeles. The steeple. So again, these outer forms. On the left is calm in a church in Paris, the center, a skyscraper in Dubai, and the one on the right, this courtyard by Antonio Gaudí in Barcelona. They look different, but they still have that rising energy. This I found in one of Jung's books on alchemy, this idea of within the mountain, the sanctuary. And these are a couple rooms in Union Station in Los Angeles. So when those were built, function took on a whole different meaning. I mean, it's like a little temple or cathedral to transportation. Now, these steeples are all different in terms of style, technology that built them, time and place, but they all have that base, middle, and top organization, that grounding in the earth, that rising highward, and that disappearing into the sky. The portal into the sanctuary is like the idea of being devoured within the belly of the whale. The one on the left is a initiation house somewhere in this area of the country, was many years ago. And on the right, this was a cafe in Paris. Totally different experience of entering that cafe. Then there's the sanctuary, the belly of the whale experience. So whether it's a Gothic cathedral or a modern cathedral, a Buddhist cave temple on the lower left, or a line of palm trees in Los Angeles, there's that similar form giving that sanctuary, belly of the whale experience, the ribs of the whale. And then there's the sanctuary, that place of arrival. So whether it's a Buddhist cave temple on the left, upper left-hand corner, just a place of a cup of flower offerings in Benares. This one I love on the upper right, that's in a tool shed at the Green Gulch Zen Center in Marin County. So there's an example of function in a tool shed. Or that sanctuary at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial on the lower left. Different outer forms, but the same core, the thread of experience. And then we get to alchemy, the transformation of materials. So I'm no expert on Jung's ideas on alchemy, but every building is a transformation of the raw materials of nature into our imagination, as we showed. This is a cave temple in India. It's a porch to a cave temple. And I show this because the raw, rough stone was carved from the imagination, was carved with imagination and shaped into this temple. So this is what we're doing all the time when we're creating places in the world. We take the raw materials, we process them, and we shape them and polish them into shimmering forms. So we take the raw materials, we work them, we work them through different processes and come up with these crystalline shimmering forms. Then there's the city, the community, the collective experience of architecture. It all comes down to the crossroads, that moment of the intersection. And then some space or plaza within the intersection of gathering. Then the definition of our collective community experience. And then the networks that allow that community to interact and communicate with itself. two different intersections, the one on the left, I think this is, yeah, that's Los Angeles. And this is a town in Iowa, in eastern Iowa, Burlington, Iowa, where the crossroads in one direction are Highway 34 and in the north-south direction, the Mississippi River. Place of gathering carved into the center of the city. Again, the shape is secondary, but the opening within the fabric of the city where it can breathe, where people can come together to have the living room of the city, allows that city to breathe. One type of gathering place, the amphitheater on the left at Epidaurus. In the middle, on the bottom, that's in Chicago. The shape of the city. In the beginning, in the old days, the shape of the city was the fortified boundaries that protected the city from invading, from the next city over. Today, those boundaries are subtler. And then there's the networks of roads that go between the different neighborhoods of the city. This is Washington, D.C. Any thoughts or questions on that? About Paris.
What's your favorite place in Seattle?
Right here, right now. Yes.
The design for Washington, D.C. was actually designed for Paterson, New Jersey.
Really? I didn't know that. Well, they both took different directions. I wonder if the design influenced that. Yes?
What's your thinking about these new 3D printers and the matrices that they, you can take the matrix from the earth and start printing a house?
To be honest, it saddens me. I mean, I love modern technology. But what we've lost by not having that handwork, you know, when it comes just about having the thing, the object, and we lose sight of the process of creating, we lose our humanity in the creation of that object, then what's the house for? What is the house? Who inhabits that house? You know, is it created by a 3D printer with people there on their laptops hooked up to more 3D printers creating more? I don't know. You know, that's an interesting question because anything can be related to soulfully if we open up enough. It's really up to us. But when, and I think we're in a phase. We're just at the beginning of the whole digital revolution. So we're totally overshadowed by the gadget. You know, and I don't know if, when someone first invented a hammer and a chisel, whether they were totally overshadowed by the hammer and the chisel, and they went, wow, look at this chisel. They got a new chisel out. You know. And this one's only 6 months old, but this new one, it's just so much better, and I've got to have it. And then after a while, people said, okay, we've got the chisel. What are we going to do with it? And then they started carving cave temples. I doubt that it was really like that, but maybe it was. Maybe the tool was overshadowing in the beginning, and we're just in that phase. I mean, it's such a radically different way of interacting with the world.
Have you written anything on architecture in the digital age?
I think I've written a couple blog posts on it, but I keep threatening myself to do it, and I just haven't taken the time. But it's if one way of looking at it, with this idea of the gateway, is the screen is the gateway. So everybody on their smartphone, they're constantly looking through that gateway. And my sense, because my own experience actually with Twitter and Facebook and things like that, is it shifted. I understood the world was a globe. But within 30 seconds, when I can communicate with someone in India, South Africa, Fresno, Japan, New York, down the block, and one person's saying good night, and the other person's saying good morning, and the other person's in the. It shifted my sense that this really is a globe. So my hope for digital communications and digital space of architecture is that it opens us up to dimensions of experience that we're not used to, that take us beyond just that fixed time and place thing. I mean, one thing I think about it, now they're talking about smart objects, you know, where your coffee maker knows your life story and says hello when you come in. And yeah, or do you want... Is that that's a reflection of the experience of indigenous people with their environment, that the environment was alive for them. Everything was speaking. And we've gotten out of touch with that. And so possibly our way back into that is with our car, our toilet, our kitchen sink, talking to us, coming alive. Yeah, exactly. And so that the world will become enchanted again until what? Somebody pulls the plug? but then maybe we'll hear the birds talking to us and the trees and the stones the way we did for thousands of years before anybody ever thought of electricity. Yes, well, Facebook will teach us that everyone is our friend. The rock, the bird, the crow. And no matter how many times we push that button of wanting to unfriend them, it won't. Nature doesn't let that happen. It's a stern teacher in terms of interconnecting us with life. You had it.
Well, I work as a psychotherapist here in town, and about a year and a half ago I went to move my office, and the original impetus, to use Neil's phrase earlier, was efficiency. I wanted an office that would save me some money because the place I was at was so expensive. And I found that. I found a lovely office that a couple hundred dollars a month less, but about 2 months ago, my landlord sent me the dutiful letter saying, according to the terms of your lease, your rent is going to go up for the second year for $9 a month. I thought, okay. And I got this idea to write a letter back to the owner of the management company that owns the building. And what was interesting to me is that the letter, came out of gratitude. I love the new space. I love the people. I love the building. I love the grounds. But nothing in my letter said, thank you for saving me $320 a month. What I went off on a tangent, the letter started out with a few things about how nice the staff is. What really made the letter interesting is I started talking about the day that I moved into this office building was the final day of what had been, it turns out, a months-long project to restore and rebuild a wisteria arbor that runs along the entire back side of the building, the portal, the door, the very simple door, but the people come in, along with a rhododendron hedge, and I was going off about how it says something about the management that they've invested in this rather than tearing it down when it got old, and I started quoting Thomas Morris. and I looked at this and I went, what, you know, that was all inside me. That's what makes this place special. What's interesting is, as I've told this story to other colleagues and friends, they all said, did the landlord write back? Like, did they
write?
Did they appreciate the and I think this, what I know of my building, he's famous locally for getting, this is a restored schoolhouse, this is where my office is in, up in Lake City. And this guy is famous for these kinds of projects, and I'll bet he's going to write back. Not yet, but it's only been a month or so, and there's kind of things on his table, but just that which seized my imagination. I was thinking in terms of your ideas of the gateways, the entrances, and every day this morning I walked in that back door, there's the wisteria in just riotous bloom, you know, and the rhododendrons are starting to, you know, to flower. I thought, this is my gateway into this place where I do this archetypal work.
Absolutely, and it's a living gateway. Because
yeah.
When those flowers come out in the spring, you know that it's spring.
And they're right outside my, I have three windows on the set that's all south-facing, my office has south-facing windows, and I wrote the landlord, and I said, all these plants dapple what might otherwise be a harsh southern exposure. You know, it makes that sort of a, more of a variegated process rather than, you know, here's the sun and draw the lines. I have these living things. I'm looking at my clients, and over their shoulder is the window, and out there is wisteria and rhododendron, and a park beyond that with huge trees. And, you know, but my point was the things that seize our imagination if we pay attention.
Right, and that's the whole point of this, that architecture and design is an incredible ally if we engage it. Yes?
Going back to the digital era question again, I have two boys, and I think a large part of their imagination today is in virtual realities. You know, they're playing these games and things like this, and I think it would be so interesting to hear you, you know, if you were to look at these games, what you would see, you know, what, and have you done
that? No, I haven't. But I know it, in the airport this morning, you know, in the security line, I'm there, I'm looking around at everything, you know, as I do. And the guy in front of me didn't look up once. He was on his iPhone the whole time looking down. There's an essay by James Hillman on ceilings that's very interesting. And he talks about how ceilings used to be magnificently designed. And the whole point of the essay is we've stopped looking up. And, yeah, there's a strange trend toward these smaller houses, you know, smaller spaces. And I see them as like cave retreats where people can then go online and go into the world of their imagination. So what the influence of that and what the effect of that is, I guess we'll find out. Yes?
I really love how you're renaming and reframing the ordinary. I'm temporarily relocated from a home into an apartment complex with an elevator and about 400 people, and it's the most exciting thing in my life. Every time I almost see that, I go, oh my God, I'm at the elevator at 10 today. It was like, that was amazing. You know, every single trip is something different. And you're explaining to me,
right. And it's different every time. You have a different cast of characters. And
someone put a car seat in a corner. It was abandoned, I guess. It was, so it was looking at the elevator. And it, nobody ever sat in it. I never took it away except for a week. It was just that some invisible person is sitting there waiting for the doors to open. And so I started telling people in the elevator. I started playing, like, why do you think it's in there? So I made a bunch of friends.
What I was just thinking of was that image of Notre Dame Cathedral, that portal with all those characters on it. And you have a kind of living portal where the characters are changing. Yes?
I was just thinking about the big thing in Seattle is building green spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got one building downtown in Central, but the newest one, I can't remember the name of it. The Bullet Foundation, have you been in it?
No. Yeah, now that's a whole other subject, is the whole ecological architecture. And a lot of it is approached with the same efficiency mentality. How can we get the BTU, how can we make it more efficient and that kind of thing? And not so much, how can we make this building an expression of nature, an expression of the processes of nature? And that the recycling of energy certainly is less, but the building is more like nature. Because for thousands of years, we've created these fortresses against nature. It's been us against the garden. And I think that attitude is still in there in a lot of ecological design.
Does the bullet building do that?
It's a living building. The weird thing is it's called a living building, or they were using that principle, but it's so strange when you look at it, it doesn't look like that at all to me. It feels very good.
Yeah. Right. Well, recently they did a new natural history museum in San Francisco. And it was this great opportunity, and they did a green roof and everything. But I was so disappointed when I went there because it was another box with displays in it. To me, it was an opportunity to say, how do we inhabit nature with, you know, birds build nests in certain ways that are in tune with the environment. How can we build our nests in just with the same poetry, not to be like a bird, but like a human being? And that is lost in a lot of the ecological stuff. It's, you know, and so I would hope, I don't know, I just wish that other dimension, because so many designs I've seen, a modernist box with some solar panels slapped on the top, and this is called a green building. But what about the green? I'm not talking about the color green, the process of green. Because in nature, there's a lot of dissolution to make it, you know, it's not about creating this fortress against nature, it's about breathing with nature. And it'd be very challenging to do that, but I think that's when we'll really create buildings that are in tune with the earth.
You talked about the architect of the entry, right? But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about windows. Mm-hmm. The inclusion of nature that you're kind of going to there, the inside to the outside, or that kind of a psychological entry into the building or exit from the building that serves a purpose too.
Well, the windows make it a habitable structure. If a building doesn't have windows, it's a tomb or a cave, but it needs some opening so for air to get in. So it's that sense of connectedness to the outside and letting the outside in and extending the inside out. This last week, outside the office window where I work, there's been a bird who was building a nest and singing wildly. Must have been some mating ritual or something, but it was fantastic to listen to the music of this bird right outside the window. And that window enlivened the space that we were in because it allowed the outside in. So it's an opportunity to blur the lines between what is architecture and what is nature. And the more we can blur the line and erase it, the more in tune we'll be with the nature, not just because it's a good thing, but the renewing cycles of nature. It allows us, you know, one thing windows do is allow us to be aware of the cycles of nature, when the sun is rising, where the sun is rising, whether it's winter or summer, whether it's a rainy day or a cloudy day. And so that connectedness, and so all of it, so that's the function, I think, of a window, is to connect us to life and the renewing cycles of life.
From the outside in as well as the inside out?
Both. It's just like with us. You know, we can say there's the inner world and the outer world, but there's really no boundary line that separates that. you know, I have to take in air. For my lungs to function, I have to take in air. So there's no separation between my lungs and the air around me. I have to take in food from the field. So there's no real separation between the food and my digestive system. And so it's a different articulation. What I would say, instead of showing us from the outside in or the inside out, it allows us to become aware of nature's relationship with itself through us. Yes, where life is on both sides. Well, one more.
I want to get your feedback on materiality. You're talking about the computer-generated materials and manufacturing materials that are taking us further from nature. It seems like there's a movement to use more honesty in materials that's a part of architecture, and how you feel that composes the space but also allows for a connection.
Well, to become aware of the and use a material for its purpose is a way for us to become more conscious of that purpose. There was a great architect named Louis Kahn in the 20th century, and he used to say, he used to have dialogue with materials. So he'd say, you say to a brick, what do you like, brick? I like an arch. Because you can put a bunch of little pieces of fired clay together and make a magnificent arch. And he'd say, well, what if you say to the brick, well, I can span that with a concrete beam more efficiently. What do you think of that, brick? Brick says, I like an arch. So each material has inherent qualities and nature. So steel has a different quality than glass, obviously, that's different than wood. And so when we're tuning in to the inherent qualities of that material and connecting it to its function, we're creating more integrity in the structure. So just like every aspect of our body, the bones, the flesh, the teeth, the hair, all of that is different material for a different function. And if we try to switch that up, the whole system would be kind of a mess. So it's an opportunity to create structures that have that kind of integrity, I think. You had a point, and then we'll go to you.
Well, just flowing back and forth between the subjects. I was with the inside, outside for just a moment. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say, I heard on the radio this morning, something that we can all stay tuned to in Seattle here, that at the airport, there's going to be an installation, whatever you call it, there are a whole lot of beehives that they're putting up. The theme is flight. In the airport, the theme is flight and bees. So they're integrating this, and they're going to have all these beehives in there and have artists are contributing their things, and there's education and so on. So that would be very interesting to do with your...
No bees in
them?
That's fantastic, a collaboration with nature. Yeah, I saw a documentary about bees not so long ago, and the main point in relationship to this lecture was they showed this bee house in Switzerland that this family had made 150 years ago. And it was like this amazing temple to the bees. And talk about connecting function on a deeper level. It wasn't just a bunch of boxes out in a field. It was, you know, whether the bees were conscious of this, that this was any different, I don't know. But the people were, in terms of their honoring of the bees. Yes?
Always hibiscus flowers. There's always birds of
Yeah. But that's been our ideal for so long, is to create this unchanging summer or spring.
Grass is always greener.
Yeah. Yeah. So, in the environments we create and live in, when we can create them in ways that acknowledge the change, that we can get that sense of renewal. We can participate in that sense of renewal. And one of the most beautiful design ideas I've heard about this. There was an architect in Berkeley in the San Francisco Bay Area in the early 20th century, Bernard Maybeck. And he designed this beautiful Christian Science church. And he made a living stained glass window by, it had frosted glass, and on the outside he planted different plants that change color at different times of the year. So that the window was always different. It was subtle, but always different color. So if you were really in tune with that, you could say, okay, that's the spring window. It's the same window. It hasn't changed. Now, to me, that's ecological architecture, or one aspect of it that we can learn from. You had.
Yeah, I was just curious about what you were saying about materials. I happen to live in a pioneer house, so it's made of old growth timber. And I was just wondering if anybody studied the difference to the psyche between living in, say, wood or stone or metal or pressed board or any.
I'm not sure if somebody studied it, but you can do your own study by just walking into those different spaces. And there is a difference. Based on the material, even if they're natural materials, I noticed going into certain cathedrals in Europe, many of them are limestone, but some of them were granite. And just this change in stone had a different feel about it. And going into a wooden structure. You had a point.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a question as much as a comment. I live in kind of a scar on the boundary of our city, where the parking area is like a goalie eroding. It's a pretty unattractive and not very well, not a nice smelling apartment. within which I live in the living room because I can't afford, right, to have a very nice space being, you know, a preschool teacher in our society. And I'm thinking about the social justice and environmental justice aspect of architecture and soulful spaces and saying like a place is soulful, whereas another place maybe doesn't seem as soulful. My sense then of this like sort of shadow side of things, like living in unloved space has a soulfulness to it. It's just really unfortunate soulful. I have a lot of questions about that and perpetuating. Psychology is complex. Having a lack of access or an outsider experience to all the places that seem moneyed and well designed.
Right. Well, the soulfulness is in the perception. And architecture is built by people who have money. And architects mostly work for people who have money. That's why it was very interesting to work with these inmates to design this meditation garden. Because these clients, had no money, and they were the most honest, straightforward people that I'd worked with. Because usually when you're working with a client, they have some image to maintain or something that goes along with the money, and there's nothing wrong with money, but the main thing is the soulfulness is in the perception. You know, you can see that. I saw this in places like Chartres Cathedral, where there's the labyrinth there, and on Friday they pull back the chairs and people can walk the labyrinth. So some people are walking the labyrinth and they're totally mindful and they're soaking in this experience. And the other people are just walking across the labyrinth, looking around, going, well, how much did this cost to build? And so that loving of unloved spaces, that's a personal thing. And in many, in quotes, unloved places, people put more energy of themselves into them because they don't have the cash to pay somebody else to do it. And so there aren't, to say, I mean, the title of my first book, The Temple and the House, Finding the Sacred in Everyday Architecture, I'm a big believer in that every place is sacred if we engage it that way. And no place is sacred if we don't engage it that way. It's not really dependent on the place so much. Some places it's easier. It gets us more in the mood. And others are more of a stretch. But I remember one time sitting in the United Airlines terminal in Chicago. My plane was delayed, so I didn't have any place to go, and just sitting there in this completely glass and steel contemporary structure. It's a beautiful space, but many people might not call it soulful. And just noticing the travelers coming, all the activity, the light coming in. And after about half an hour, I was almost in tears, just perceiving the beauty of this place. And it's not because I'm great or anything like that. It's just a delayed flight forced me to sit there and open up to it. And so whether we're living out of a backpack or have a 20,000 square foot house, the soulfulness and sacredness and access to the archetypes that are embodied in design is the way we perceive it. And that's all I've done here is say, okay, here's maybe some ways to think about this that might help that. Yes?
You ran across a little bit of an ethical dilemma that I wonder if you've run across. A good example might be putting on a roof. We loved a cedar-shaped roof. Mm.
Some dilemmas can't be resolved. But in a culture that took care of the earth and did conscious forestry practices, we would be able to have that. But now we can't because, you know, our culture rapes the earth instead. So then I think it's a matter of attuning your aesthetics to what is working within the situation in the most integrated and holistic way. And yes, cedar shakes are beautiful, but to me it would be, how can I find the beauty in some alternative material? Yeah, you know, find and do it in a way that has imagination in it. You know, take the off-the-shelf material and take the off-the-shelf look of it and weave into it a different way of doing it.
yes. So appreciate the soulful and imaginative way you're approaching architecture. Are you hopeful that this is getting across to architectural students?
No.
Well, they just don't hear about it, you know. Well, in some schools they've used it in that way, but it's not so much, you know. And I'm not a kind of zealot that's out there on a mission. I just put it out there and. Yes, or maybe some zealots can come along and throw me to the lions more often. But thank you for that. Yes.
When you showed the house in Connecticut that has the glass wall in front of that house connected to the exterior, it made me think about the stone circles that are peppered all over, you know, Europe, most of them probably further, where they were really with a very broad landscape using these huge stones to create a space. Mm-hmm. And that space, the stones themselves were aligned to certain things on the horizon, like the hill top or the kind of the bottom, from right in that center that appeared to be that way, in alignment with some celestial thing, solstice,
right.
Sunrise, or sunset or something. So that's really connected. That's really being intentional and creating a space in alignment with the surroundings. And it made me think about Seattle. And so I'd like to ask your observations about this, because we're very north-south.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're constrained by the bodies of water on both sides, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really feel psychically that Seattle only is that wide. For me, it's from the mountains of the Olympics to the mountains of the Cascades. Like we're in the middle of this big bowl, you know, with water and just narrow strip. Coming into Seattle, I wonder what your observations are about that.
No, I appreciate your description, because I experienced what you were talking about. You know, there's obviously that north-south line, but there is that bowl. You know, we were down by the water when the clouds opened up a little bit, and you could see the mountains in the distance and that ring of that. And there is that kind of bowl feeling. And I don't know. You described my experience, but I don't know what more to say about it than that.
What just came to my mind is when you were talking about bring what you have, you know, into your life, into your psyche. As far as the solstices go, you know, I have a tree that there's a specific tree that when the sun sets there in the summer, that's my solstice tree. So I create these own markings off my deck that delineate the seasons, and you know, oh, it seems so far from the solstice tree, and yet you know it passes and comes back so quickly. So that's kind of how I make do with living in the Northwest.
And it's interesting how we use these fixed objects to experience the changing, the process. And that's another aspect of architecture, is it's a fixed object that allows us to participate and become aware of the changing aspects of life and that changing energy of life and that renewal. Because just imagine if the sun rose in the same place every day, so you had one, you wouldn't even need to have one marker. And so by marking up, by marking off these spaces, we participate in that fluidity, and that's one of the mysteries of architecture, is that it seems fixed and solid, but where it comes alive is through change, through all the people in the elevator, you know, through the sun rising, from the wistaria blooming in the spring and dying back in the winter. So everything has its mood and its own poetry and change, But it's the fixed structure that allows that fluid structure to be perceived. Yes?
I'm rethinking sidewalks with the night-day thing. I live in an area similar to yours, I think, but sort of a neglected neighborhood. We don't have sidewalks, and there's been this big cry from the sidewalks and sidewalks. But after 12 years, compared to Capitol Hill, as a walker in the city, on Capitol Hill, I can count on one hand the number of strangers who look me in the eye and said hello in 25 years. If people were on sidewalks, they would not engage. With no sidewalks during the day, everyone's in the street. But the other time, I have to walk about 10 club blocks at night towards Aurora, which is our dangerous street, and terrible things happen on Aurora. And so I took the new street that had the new sidewalk on one side, and I started out afraid, and then as I got closer to a low income apartment complex, well, guess what? The people in the wheelchairs were out there smoking on the sidewalk. People were chatting, and it seemed almost sacred because no one was looking at a device. I mean, it was really interesting. It at night, the sidewalk became a friend, and it fostered the interactions.
Well, absolutely. And Jane Jacobs was famous for pointing this out in New York with all the stoops on the street, where people would use those stoops as their outdoor room, living room. And so people were out on the street, so the neighborhood was safer because you didn't need surveillance cameras because you had hundreds of pairs of eyes. You had surveillance. And people knew each other. It wasn't even anonymous surveillance. They knew where you lived. Yes. That sounds delightful. We'll do that.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.